Welcome to Changing the Narrative with Dina Eccles. Over the past year, I've realized the significance of making a way for Palestinian voices to be heard. The din of misinformation, some deliberate, some out of ignorance, has been with us for decades. So when I was given the opportunity to sit in conversation with acclaimed Palestinian poet, short story writer, and essayist Musab Abu Toha, I took the chance and here we are. His first collection of poetry, Things You May Find Hidden in My Ear, was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award for Poetry and won the Palestine Book Award, the American Book Award, and the Walcott Poetry Prize. Abu Toha is also founder of the Edward Said Library in Gaza, which he hopes to rebuild. He recently won an Overseas Press Club Award for his Letter from Gaza columns for The New Yorker. Welcome, Musab, and thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Well, I have to tell you, the other night I spent reading Forest of Noise, your most recent collection of poetry, and it was compelling. The depth of your connection to the land and the people just touched me so much, and as did the revelations about the cruelty of war. So I especially appreciated how you address the restrictions and the humanities that Palestinians have faced over the decades. So would you like to comment on that or begin with that?
Yeah, thank you so much for this space. And I believe what's been happening to the Palestinian people, especially these days in Gaza, has been going on for decades, as you said. But the difference now is that what's happening in Gaza is well documented and well watched by so many people around the world. And it devastates me that my grandparents in 1948 and there's so many hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who were expelled from their houses and their cities and villages 76 years ago did experience something similar, but they did not have Instagram, they did not have internet connection to post and update the whole world about what they were experiencing, their journeys of the mass exodus that they took, and which still continues until this day. The Palestinian refugees are living in the Gaza Strip, in the West Bank, in refugee camps in Jordan, in Lebanon, and in Syria. And not only that, but they continue to be killed. Their children continue to be killed, and their grandchildren continue to be killed. So what Israel is doing these days is not only killing people, but they are also killing refugees who have survived for 76 years. They are destroying the refugee camps. So they are destroying everything, the human in us, the memories in us, the history in us.
Right, and that's why I found your books so important. Just human being to human being. I was wondering if you would read from your first book, Things You May Have Hidden in My Ear, that particular poem, because I think it captures,
everything.
The one, Things You May Have Hidden in, Things You May Find Hidden in My Ear.
Sure. The title poem.
Right.
Things You May Find Hidden in My Ear, for Alicia M. Quesnel, MD. One. When you open my ear, touch it gently. My mother's voice lingers somewhere inside. Her voice is the echo that helps me recover equilibrium when I feel dizzy during my attentiveness. You may encounter songs in Arabic, poems in English I recite to myself, or a song I chant to the chirping birds in our backyard. When you stitch the cut, don't forget to put all these back in my ear. Put them back in order as you would do with the books on your shelf. Two, the drone's buzzing sound, the roar of an F-16, the screams of bombs falling on houses, on fields, and on bodies, of rockets flying away, rid my tiny ear canal of them all. Spray the perfume of your smiles on the incision, inject the song of life into my veins to wake me up. Gently, beat the drum so my mind may dance with yours, my doctor, day and night.
Thank you. Again, your words are so compelling. They so much bring to life the suffering. And it's I feel like it's so important that people are able to grasp this, hear this. So it's really important. And I understand that you lived in a refugee camp.
Yeah, I was born in a refugee camp in 1992 until the age of 8. We moved to Beit Lahia, where my family still lives. And the house where which my father and my mother and we together built was bombed in an airstrike on October 28th last year.
And that's one of the things that compelled you to leave.
Yeah, so we left our house 2 weeks before the house was bombed. So we evacuated to a refugee camp to stay with my mother's family there. And then we had one of my children is an American citizen. He was born in Boston in 2020 while I was doing a fellowship here. And we had the chance to leave Gaza through the American embassy. But on the way, as you know, I was abducted by the Israeli army. And I was blindfolded and handcuffed and so many things before I was released. And even when I was abducted, when I was blindfolded and handcuffed for 3 days, I did not know whether my wife and kids, who themselves did not know where they would go without me, were still alive or not. So I lost everything in Gaza. I lost 30 members of my extended family. And this morning, I woke up with the heartbreaking news that a cousin of mine, 7 years old, Sama, her name is Sama, was killed in an airstrike that also killed her grandmother and about 14 members of her family. My aunt, who was living there with her five daughters, one of them was killed, survived the airstrike just to see Israeli soldiers approaching the bombed house under which still 15 members of her family are still buried. Was visited by Israeli soldiers. I mean, after they killed the family, I was on the phone 3 hours ago, and I called my aunt, and she said the house was four floors. So she survived the airstrike because she was staying near the door. And she was visited by, after she survived the death with her four daughters and her husband, she was visited by a soldier, and she was begging him to let her walk and take. And before she could walk, she begged him if she could take some food that she had for the children. So there were no ambulances, no fire trucks, no rescue teams. So she had to walk while she was injured with her injured daughters for a few hundred meters before they could see other people who could give them some help. So I lost so many things. I lost so many things in Gaza, and I barely lost my life in some airstrikes before I left Gaza.
Right, so you were injured. You were injured even before this year. What, isn't that right?
Yeah, I was injured when I was 16 years old. That was 2009. I got two pieces of shrapnel in my body, one in my neck and one in my forehead. And I even did not know at the time that I had two pieces of shrapnel in my body. So I had to go on a surgery to extract the two pieces of shrapnel, which I kept in my house until our house was bombed last October. So the shrapnel that survived with me in my body are under the rubble of my house.
I can't even fathom. And I've been staying very closely attentive to what's been happening for the past year. I can't even fathom what it's like for you to have to even be on these talk shows and communicate as you do. But it's so important that you are, because even knowing that this occurred to you when you were 16 helps people understand that this is something that's been going on, because it's the
Exactly.
indoctrination, you know? And you lost a brother.
Yeah, my brother died because he was sick. That was 2016. He was sick, and Gaza lacks so many things, not the least of which is medicine and healthcare. So yeah, we couldn't get him out of Gaza because of the siege. I mean, we couldn't. I mean, we live in a place that, I mean, whose border crossing points we do not control. You
Right.
know, Gaza, Israel is occupying the sea, so there is no way that we could travel on the sea. We can't leave Gaza. We don't have an airport. Israel destroyed the Gaza International Airport in 2000 after it was created. After, I mean, 2 months, two years after it was created. And till today, there is no seaport in Gaza for the past, I mean, forever. I don't remember that there was a seaport in Gaza because Israel is occupying the sea. So there is no way for us in Gaza to leave, you know, for medical purposes, for tourism purposes, for anything. And there's no way for people like you to come to Gaza to visit us and see us and say hi and drink tea with us. No. So not people in Gaza are unable to leave for different purposes for which many people, you know, leave their countries and return. And there is no way for foreigners to come and visit people in Gaza.
And when I read your poetry about life there, like all, especially when you talk about the oranges or sharing the tea, it's such a precious, those are such precious memories and important ones because they're so human. There's so many cultures that live in this way. I know I grew up in an Italian family and that we shared, we, you know, there were, it was a little Italian town, really. So it was very similar in what we shared. And so that's something we can relate to. So would you like to read another poem that tells of life there?
Yeah, I have a long poem from my first collection that's called Palestine AZ.
Okay.
And there are so many parts in it that tells you about how life was like in Gaza before October 7th and under the siege and the occupation. So let me tell you about my home. What is home? It is the shade of trees on my way to school before they were uprooted. It is my grandparents' black and white wedding photo before the walls crumbled. It is my uncle's prayer rug, where dozens of ants slept on wintry nights before it was looted and put in a museum. It is the oven my mother used to bake bread and roast chicken before a bomb reduced our house to ashes. It is the cafe where I watched football matches and played. My child stops me. Can a four-letter word hold all of these? So there is in Palestine AZ, for example, the letter O. Yaffa is known around the world for its oranges. My grandmother Khadra tried to take some oranges with her in 1948, but the chilling was heavy. The oranges fell on the ground. The earth drank their juice. It was sweet, I am sure. In Gaza, we had a clay oven that our neighbor Munir built for us. When my mother wanted to bake, I fed it wood stems or cardboard to heat it for the bread. The wood stems were made from dried plants, pepper, eggplant, and corn stalks.
So I so much appreciate these poems of yours, but just the remembrances, so powerful. You also were the founder of the Edward Said Library, 2019, I believe.
Yeah, so there are two branches of the library. There were two branches of the one that I started, which was in 2017. It is in Bethlehem, North Gaza. And now the library is in damage. So, but one of the librarians could rescue some of the books there. The second branch was opened in 2019, and it's in Gaza City. And that branch is destroyed. The third library is my home library, which was my home. And in that library, I had hundreds of books, many of which were signed by friends who I met in the States when I went for a few months. And one of the books was gifted to me by Rifat al-Ar'ir, the Palestinian poet who was killed with his sister and her children and husband. The author of the poem "If I Must Die." So he gave me a copy of his book "Gaza Writes Back," and not only did he sign it to me, but he wrote, "Palestine is a story away." And in return, when I had published my first poetry book, "Things You May Find Hidden in My Ear," I gave him a copy of my book, and I signed it to him, and I said, "Palestine is a poem away." So that was my response, to him by giving him another book, but a poetry book, and telling him that Palestine could be a story away, but also a poem away. And we need to find the story or the poem that could lead us to Palestine.
So beautifully said. And yes, I remember reading his poem. It really went viral
Yeah.
and I think impacted a lot of people. Can you tell us what led to the creation of the Edward Said Library?
Yeah, basically, Gaza has been under siege since 2007, and it's been under occupation forever. And as a child, I never remember that I went to a library in the refugee camp. I don't remember my father taking me to a library because there was no library in the refugee camp. So my love for books started as I grew up in the refugee camp and then in Beit Lahia, and then I studied English language teaching and literature at the Islamic University of Gaza. So, using my language and communicating with and making friends with people outside of Gaza. So that was another way of breaking the siege, which is by being in touch with people outside of Gaza on Facebook. It was Facebook mainly. So the English department of my university was bombed in an airstrike, and that was 2014. So I visited the English department, which was in ruins, and I found a copy of the Norton Anthology of American Literature under the rubble. So I rescued that book and I took a picture of it, and then I gave it to the security personnel there. And then I posted that on Facebook, and that's when some friends on Facebook, offered to send me books, as a gift. So I started collecting books, over time. And I also reached out to Noam Chomsky, who once visited the Islamic University of Gaza in 2012. And I asked him if he could send me some of his books, which is something that he did. So I started to create, my small book collection. And then I thought about, when I saw that so many other people are interested in sending me books, I thought maybe I should create a public library, which everyone could use. And that's what happened. So I launched a fundraising campaign, to rent a place and buy, the chairs and the tables and the shelves. So that was one reason why I created the library, which is that Gaza is under siege and people can't get books easily. So one way for me was to bring books to them in a public space where they could borrow books, but also could meet and talk about their books. The books that they love.
Right. I had to Google more about it so I could understand. And I saw that there was something in January, there was a virtual listening, and it was called A Reading for the Edward Said Libraries with Mossab Abu Toha and Friends. And I can tell you, I've been listening. It's long, but the poems are so powerful and so beautiful. And the spirit of community that you're creating and have been creating for so long. And I feel very honored to now be a little part of that. So
Thank
have
you.
be able to share your poetry. And so would you like to read another poem?
Sure. So I, you know what? I will read my poem, My Library, which is part of my second poetry book. This poem was written before October 7th, because half of the poems in the new book were written before October 7th, and the other half was written after. My library. My books remain on the shelves as I left them last year, but all the words have died. I search for my favorite book out of place. I find it lying lonely in a drawer next to the photo album and my old Nokia phone. The pen inside the book is still intact, but some ink drops have leaked. Some words breathe its ink, the pen like a ventilator for a dozen patients. Home, Jerusalem, the sea, Haifa, the rock, the oranges, the sand, the pigeon, Cairo, my mother, Beirut, books, the rock, the sea, the sea.
That connection to the earth is something that Indigenous peoples have. And it, I think it's so critically important. And that loss of it is one of the reasons that I think people don't really understand and have lost compassion, have lost empathy. You know, I think, yeah. So it's so important. I really hope that people are hearing this and will take you up on reading your fine poetry and your remembrances and everything that you hold in you. You have a poem, My Grandfather's Well, and in it, now I'm going to read to you. In the refugee camp where land is strewn with debris, where air chokes with rage, my harvest is yet to arrive. My seeds only sprout on this page. And I want to make sure you know how much your seeds are sprouting. And, you know, so happy.
I hope I will see the, you know, the flowers and the trees that will give shade to the people who are burning in the sun, not the sun, in the ball of flames of this, you know, genocidal occupation that's been killing my people on camera.
Yes, and we need to get that out. We need it to be understood, and we need people to stand up and demand for something different.
Yeah.
So is there another poem you would like to read?
I would like to read, you know, one special poem that I like in my poetry, in my second poetry book, which is called For a Moment. And I wrote this poem, by the way. I mean, some of the poems were written after I lived something, you know, in Gaza. And some of the poems, for example, the book My Library, which is something based on, which is a poem that's based on a real experience. But the poem For a Moment, it's about a video that I watched of a young man carrying the body of a girl and running in the hospital. And I mean, why would someone run with the body of someone who is already dead? I mean, what is the point in running? I mean, there is no, I mean, so I mean, I, so one of the reasons why I write poetry, or why I think I write poetry, is that I as a human being try to understand what's happening in a world that doesn't make sense. I mean, that didn't make sense to me why he is running with the body of a girl when she is dead. So in this poem, I as a human being try to make sense, try to not make sense, I try to make sense. And it's called For a Moment. And it's in my book, Forest of Noise, page 74. For a moment. Her small body rides in my arms as I run to the hospital. There is no electricity and the inner hallways are forest like, okay. There is no electricity and the inner hallways are a forest lined with cots. The girl I carry is dead. I know that. The pressure of the explosion tore apart her thin veins. I know she is dead, but everyone who sees us runs after us. You are alive for a moment when living people run after you. So
Can you?
I was thinking that these people who were running after this guy who was carrying the dead body of a girl, that they were trying, you know, because they are living, they have their hearts beating. I thought they were trying to give her life by running, you know, by creating some kind of, I mean, by creating a sign of life by running. Yeah.
Yeah, and you added in Forest of Noise, Audre Lorde's quote, "Poetry is not luxury."
Yeah.
And I think that's also a very important understanding, what it takes for you to do what you do.
Yeah, and I believe that this, you know, this quote from the great Audre Lorde is not only about writing poetry. You know, poetry itself is not a luxury. It's not something that we do because we are privileged people. No, or because we are rich, we have, you know, more treasures than other people, you know. So it's not only about writing poetry that is really painful, but it's also about reading the poems that you have written to other people, sharing your work with other, sharing your pain with other people. So writing poetry is not a luxury. Reading poetry is not a luxury, you know. So this is what makes it even more meaningful for me to use the quote.
Yes. Well, I picked up on that right away. That you, anyway, the depth of everything that you do is really touching, and I'm thrilled to have this conversation with you. I urge people to find your work and buy it and read it and share it. I would suggest people listen to the virtual a reading for the Edward Said Libraries with Masab Abu-Toha and friends. And I hope that your new book reaches many, many people. Is there anything else that you would like to share, or any other poetry before we?
So I mean, I will end with a poem, but before that, I would encourage people and tell them that it is a must that people not listen, I mean, to stories about Palestinians, but they must listen to stories from Palestinians. There is a difference, a big difference between hearing a story about someone, you know. From it's different from listening to the story from this person, and this is, you know, this is what I criticize about the media, which is that we get to hear, you know, analysts, officials, you know, talking about the situation in Palestine, in Gaza. You know, they share with us some updates about, you know, the food trucks, or, you know, the vaccines, the number of the people who were killed, the number of the fuel trucks that are entering Gaza, you know, the number of airstrikes, you know, the number of people who were killed or wounded. But we don't get to hear the people who are really suffering. We need the voices of the people who are really suffering to talk. I don't want you to hear about me. I want you to hear me talking. This is what is lacking in the world. So always seek the voices of the people talking about themselves, not seek the voices of people who are talking about others. I mean, we have our own voices and they need to be heard. Maybe in the past, Palestinians didn't have, you know, the luxury of speaking and using language because they have been oppressed all the time. They have been, I mean, their vocal cords have been snatched from their throats. But now the Palestinian people have so many people. I mean, who could really talk about the issue? Who could talk about our dreams, our pain, our hopes, our demands? We don't want anyone to talk on our behalf, to say, oh, maybe the Palestinians should do this or that. No, you don't get to say this. I tell you what I'm asking for. You don't get to tell me one about two-state solution or one state. I'm the one who should talk about this, not you. It is my land. It is my grandparents who were expelled in 1948. It is our issue, not the American issue, not the British issue, not the European issue, not the Asian. It's the Palestinian issue, and they should tell you what the solution would be. You cannot offer them a solution. They should tell you what the solution would be. Yeah, so I will read one last poem, and this poem, is about the so many people who have been buried under the rubble of their houses, including today the family of my aunt in Jabalia camp, 15 members who are still under the rubble. And I was told today that one child is still alive, but is still under the rubble. So this poem is called Right or Left. Under the rubble, her body has remained for days and days. When the war ends, we try to remove the rubble, stone after stone. We only find one small bone from her body. It is a bone from her arm. Right or left, it does not matter as long as we cannot find the henna from her neighbor's wedding on her skin, or the ink from a school pen on a little index finger. And the henna is something, we use
Yes.
to it's something like that too, but it's made from plants. So yeah, it's very painful, even, to think about my relatives who are still under the rubble of the house. Yeah. I have a close friend of mine, Ismail Abu Ghabin, whose body and the body of his father and the body of his sister are still under the rubble since last November. So you can't you I mean I come to think that the word genocide is not the appropriate word. There should be another word for what's happening in Gaza. It's more than a genocide. You are not even killing people, but you are even depriving the people of offering their support and help. You are preventing people, you are depriving people of the chance to bid their relatives farewell. I mean, 11 months under the rubble, what has remained of the body today? I don't know. A bone? Yeah.
In a way, I could keep this going on and on and on, but I want us to be able to get it to let this be complete so that it could be heard by many people. But I
Thank you,
really
Dean.
want to thank you. I really want to thank you. And I want to tell everyone you've been listening to Changing the Narrative with acclaimed Palestinian poet Mosab Abu Taha. He recently participated in the Wisconsin Book Festival in Madison. His newly released book of poetry, Forest of Noise, is a powerful human account of needless suffering and of the unrelenting power of the human spirit to survive and to thrive. It's really been an honor to speak with you, Masab.
Thank you so much. I really love that. Thank you so much.